you very much.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, Professor Zirilli, and thank you for inviting me here to the University of Chicago. I'm very pleased to be here and to see all of you. I'm a little shocked by the weather, but since I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, and received all my degrees there, it's not too much of a shock. I learned to adjust to that. On January 14th in 2005, I was one of the invited speakers at Harvard when President Larry Summers made his now infamous remarks. In fact, I was sitting right next to Nancy Hopkins, who is a friend of mine, and we were quite appalled and shocked at his remarks. As Professor Zirilli suggests, first of all, there was the whole notion that he stated that women are unwilling or unable to work the 80-hour work weeks required for success in science at the top-flight academic institutions, which astounded most of us who think nothing of working 80 hours a week. The second thing he suggested, which really probably garnered the most media attention, was this notion that innate or biological factors rather than socialization probably account for sex difference in mathematical aptitude and also for adult preferences in choice of academic study and occupational field. The third thing he said, which really didn't get as much media coverage, but I have to say, particularly as an administrator, I found equally offensive, which was discrimination, which he defined as a taste for hiring people like oneself, does not exist in academia, he said, because that would be eliminated through market forces by lesser institutions hiring highly qualified women and minorities, therefore by gaining a competitive advantage. Now, he was an economist, and so he was sort of building on Gary Becker's theory that people, the market would take care of the forces if there were a hiring situation like that. Although many of us were quite shocked and appalled by his remarks, and we recognized immediately what had gone on, the positive aspect of this is that it did make people take seriously the research that many of us had done and the comments that many of us had made for years about what we knew was the situation, which there was still considerable bias against women in science and engineering. And I think for that aspect, we'll always be grateful to President Summers, although it certainly was probably one of the factors that led to his being removed as president at Harvard. The types of barriers and obstacles and discrimination that women scientists, engineers, and I faced 30 or 40 years ago, and some that slightly younger women face today, or 10 or 20 years ago, appear overt and obvious. These days, some of the same issues exist, but they tend to be presented in slightly more subtle fashion, different language. What I tend to think of as old wine in new bottles, so that many of the same issues have persisted for the last 30 or 40 years. And so this book that I wrote, I talked about some of the experiences that occurred to me. And then I interviewed about 450 women scientists and engineers. And I would like to say right out of the gate that all of these individuals are very successful. They were either NSF awardees that had received Power Awards, Professional Opportunities for Women in Research and Education. Some of them were Clare Booth Luce Fellows. And then I did interview the senior AWIS Fellows. All of these individuals were in tenure-track positions in academic institutions, and as you can see, they were successful grant winners. So the issue for them was not that they were unsuccessful or people who were malcontent, and they all also very much wanted to continue their science. However, what they found was that they had some barriers and obstacles and bias, often unintentional, that was thrown in their way that prevented them from perceiving and attaining some of the goals that they'd like to meet in science and engineering. And so I wrote this book to talk a little bit about that, about my experiences from many years ago, about what's going on today, and also about what we might all do together to make sure that everybody reaches the productivity that they would like to have. When I began my undergraduate education in science more than 40 years ago, I experienced mentoring from faculty that encouraged me to continue in science, as well as some comments that had a decidedly chilling effect and made me question my choice of major. For example, one faculty member who noticed how well I had done in Genetics for Poets. This was the course for non-science majors, because when I came back from Europe between high school and college and entered my first year, all the courses in science were closed, and it was okay. I thought I was going to be an English and French major. And so I didn't take any science courses the first semester, and it wasn't until second semester when I signed up for Genetics and Human Affairs. And I got the highest grade in the class. The professor asked me to work in his lab. I was very excited about this and started working in the lab. And he was the one who actually persuaded me to go into biology. He kept saying, why don't you take a biology course? You should be a biology major. Go ahead and take a biology course, which I eventually decided to do. I was a double major in French and biology because, having had a great deal of French in high school, it was not too difficult to get the double major at the undergraduate level. However, I ended up having somewhat mixed feelings about it, because almost every time that he asked me whether I shouldn't major in biology, he would also accompany that with a kiss or with feeling me up or something like that. It was what we today define as sexual harassment. At that time, that vocabulary had not yet been invented. And it wasn't until a few years later, as a graduate student, when we had consciousness-raising groups. I was in a group with several other women graduate students, that many of us learned that we had had similar experiences, a few of us from this same professor, actually. And we learned that it wasn't because our skirts were too short or something we had said or something about that, that it was actually about power. And that was when sexual harassment was invented. As a graduate student and a postdoc, I encountered a different set of mixed messages from mentors in society that left me with some ambiguous feelings about beginning my career as a professor of biology. On the one hand, I regularly heard how well I was progressing towards my dissertation. Indeed, I received my PhD 4 years after my undergraduate degree, while at that time the average in the zoology department was about 7 years to get the PhD. And I had a baby during that time. Yet, I also had a U.S. museum-based research question selected for me by my major professor, because when he learned I was pregnant, rather than go to Africa, as his other students did, to study the Australopithecines, he set up a project for me here at the Field Museum in Chicago. And when I said, well, why would I be doing that? Why wouldn't I be going to Africa like your other students? He said, what would a pregnant woman do in Africa? And besides, what would your husband think? And so this was the kind of ambiguous situation I faced. I felt a bit deprived of choosing my own dissertation topic. On the other hand, as a faculty member, I can see that many times less life-changing circumstances than going to Africa and having a baby derail a career. And I did end up finishing my PhD. So I have mixed feelings about whether he did the right thing or not. I know that in his mind, he thought he was doing the right thing for me, and he did get me through. The data from the responses and interviews of these over 450 women suggest that the situation has changed a little bit. Some of the very overt messages that I received, for example, as a postdoc when I got pregnant with my second child, I was told by the professor with whom I was working to get an abortion. It was the wrong time in the research. We needed to get more data to get the grant renewed. Nobody would say that sort of thing anymore. It's highly illegal. On the other hand, many of the young women scientists expressed that people know what the code questions are to get at the issue of what are your plans, which actually the question is, what are your plans for the future? And many women feel that depending upon the answer they give to that question may determine whether or not they receive the position, the postdoctoral situation, or whatever they are working towards. So let me show you a little bit what some of the women themselves say. Here is an example of biologist Opal Wirtz. She said that when she finally went on the job market after a lengthy postdoc, she inspected her options quite carefully to be certain she didn't land in another impossible situation. She had experienced sexual harassment while she was in her graduate program. And so when she began to look at the hiring situation, she found that there was the institution that was offering her a position was under heavy pressure from the dean to hire a woman. And she felt and heard rumors about sexual harassment in the department. And she decided not to go to that private Midwestern Research One university. It was not this institution. By the way, I've changed the names of all the institutions and the people. What happened was that the person who took the position did end up suing the university because she did experience sexual harassment. And so this is the kind of situation that folks still do face and learn to try to ferret out and resist. Biologist Sherry Colby had an incredibly supportive spouse to whom she'd been married for quite a long time. After receiving her degree in biology, she worked for the government as a physical science technician. She then pursued a master's degree and then a PhD. Although she loved doing research, she had an extremely negative postdoctoral experience with a very sexist advisor. Because of this, she sought a position at a small teaching-oriented institution. And you can see, though, what happened to her, and this is a point I would like to make because it comes out in the literature over and over that often, because of difficult situations women have had in their graduate programs or postdoctoral experiences, they seek non-Research One institutions. They view small liberal arts colleges as more family-friendly. And although I think small liberal arts colleges are great, in fact, I began my own career at one, they are risky from the point of view of allowing the woman to retain her research. You know, they're only 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And basically, the demands at the small liberal arts college are different. Often there are higher teaching loads, more expectations for advising students, perhaps being around on the weekends for parent events and dealing with student organizations. And so many of the women at these institutions find that although they're family friendly, they end up losing their research as a consequence of the situation. So I want to point that out because there is this big trend now of a lot of women. It's true also of men. If you look at the research of Marianne Mason at Berkeley, where she showed both women and men graduate students become less interested in going to Research One institutions throughout their graduate career, but it's particularly true of the women students. What about the situation with regard to pregnancy? I already talked a little bit about my situation in terms of what happened as a graduate student, being assigned a different question for my dissertation, and then as a postdoc being told to get an abortion. This persists and occurs, unfortunately, with other individuals, too. Sue Perimeter, who was a geologist, was fortunate in that her undergraduate advisor maintained confidence in her because she had a very negative experience at the big state research university where she attended graduate school. Because she was married and had a baby, people perceived her as a joke who wasn't serious about science. Conversations with her undergraduate mentor provided her with the courage to seek a new advisor when her initial advisor let her go. And that advisor enabled her to complete her master's degree. Because of this, she always tries to convey positive impressions to her students about the possibilities of combining motherhood and science. A complicating situation for a lot of women in science is the dual career situation. And sometimes it comes across in very direct forms, sometimes it's indirect. First, let me give another example of the pregnancy effect. This is Martine Ryerson. She actually waited until after she achieved tenure to become pregnant the first time, which is what sometimes is suggested. You know, I'm often on these panels where people say, well, when is the best time if you want to have children to do that? And I usually say, there is not, you know, there's no one set time that's good. In some ways, it's good to have them when you're in graduate school. There's probably more freedom in terms of the time clock. It's very demanding with the tenure clock. On the other hand, a lot of people feel it's better to wait till after you have tenure. It really depends on the individual. But Martine Ryerson completed her PhD at age 24 in Britain. She came to Canada for a postdoc, and then she decided to stay in North America. She didn't get married until she achieved tenure. But when she became pregnant with her second child, who turned out to be twins, one of her colleagues said, you know, why wasn't one child enough? What's the story here? And unlike the young male colleague who was put up for early promotion to full professor, the department did not support that for her. She resented that, even though she was quite strong and went ahead to make professor within 10 years of receiving her PhD. Because of that, she left and became a dean at a public Midwestern institution. Then she became a provost in the Mid-Atlantic region, and I would say actually since the book has come out, she's now a president at an East Coast university. So she definitely succeeded, but the university where she began her career, she still resents very much. Here's engineer Sharon Smokes. After having a baby and experiencing some health problems, and here's where you begin to see the dual career situation getting entangled. She thought about leaving her faculty position, partly because her husband had received a job in the Northeast. And also, she had a bad department chair who would not let her submit an NSF grant. Luckily, she was able to submit through another organization, and this eventually led to her receiving a faculty position that was near her husband. How serious is the dual career situation? If you know the study out of Stanford University on dual careers, you know that it's a big issue throughout academia in general. And I would say as provost, one of the things I spend a lot of time on, and I spent a lot of time as a dean on this, was trying to get this dual career situation settled. And in fact, I would say we probably lose more hires through trying to work out the and being unsuccessful in working out the dual career situation than any one single factor. The reason it's particularly an issue for women in science and engineering is that 83% of women scientists or engineers are partnered with a scientist or engineer, whereas only 54% of men scientists or engineers are partnered with a scientist or engineer. And it's also the percentage of women scientists and engineers partnered with somebody in science and engineering seems to be higher than that for other fields. Often people are in exactly the same field. You know, they may be met during graduate school, and that makes it really tough, as you know, to get positions at many institutions. Another issue that starts to come into play is the actual child rearing. And this can begin to happen almost immediately after birth, and in fact, I had a personal experience along these lines too. the same man with whom I was postdocing, who had told me to get an abortion because it was the wrong time in the research, you need to get more data to get the grant renewed. I should have taken the hint then, but being, you know, a little dense, I didn't get it. And so after the baby was born, I had very carefully selected a babysitter who lived in married student housing that was close to campus. And at noon, I would go out and nurse the baby, which I thought would be an okay thing to do since many of the guys went out and played squash over the noon hour. But apparently, this was not so great. So one day, I came back from lunch, and the male postdoc on the way in said, could be a bad situation. A call came about your part of the research from Cornell over the noon hour, and I think the head of the lab is going to be upset. So I went in there, and he was indeed, you know, racing around the lab and was very upset about, you know, where I was and what was going on. I said, look, I was out nursing the baby. I thought that'd be okay. Oh, can't do that, da, 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 da. Anyway, that actually is what led me to leave doing that and get involved in women's studies. And so in some ways, I've never regretted that, but that doesn't seem the reason that that should have happened. Environmental engineer Karen Frost was a little more savvy in her approach to things. She said that since the time to interview for jobs occurred right after her baby was born, she had to really work that into the interview process and explicitly ask for time to do that. Now, a lot of people are not as brave as she was to ask for that. But as she said, this constraint made her carefully select the number and places to interview. And even though the department consisted of older, entrenched men, she received and accepted an offer from the New England Public University because these men didn't seem to have any problem with her doing that. And that worked out very well for her. And in fact, it's been a supportive department. So it ended up being kind of a test case that she could use to see what would happen. In a similar vein, chemist Angelina Longini tried to work out her dual career situation. During her last 2 years of graduate school, she had a commuter marriage because her husband had taken a position on the East Coast. And the first year, living as a single parent, she felt pretty constrained. But the second year, her husband took the child, and that allowed her to finish her PhD. But then she decided they really needed to be together. And this is often the case with the dual career situation, particularly if they're trying to combine it with child rearing. It can be tough to live across a continent from each other. And so she stayed in a postdoc for 5 years where her boss used her to run the lab. And this is a common pattern that also emerges in the research on women in science and engineering. Often, the woman will take a lesser position or remain in a geographically constricted area which doesn't allow the scientific advancement she might seek because she is trying to work out the dual career situation. And she got ready really to leave the field when fortunately a position emerged at a women's college at that time. I'm sure many of you here keep up with the national data on what's going on with postdocs, and you see that the numbers of women in postdocs is increasing, and they're remaining longer in the postdoctoral positions, and some of them then often get trapped in these kind of dead-end situations where it's impossible then eventually to get into a faculty position. Much of that is because of the dual career situation. This is why you get that trapping in that kind of situation. Now I want to talk a little bit about the impact of mentoring, because one of the major reasons that I wrote the book was to express what was going on with women scientists and engineers, but also to provide a guide for mentors, and many of the mentors, of course, in science and engineering are men. And this is because of the numbers of who's at the top, and I'll show those in a few minutes. And I think most male mentors really want to do a good job and really want to encourage women in science and engineering. But often they do not understand that mentoring the women scientists and engineers in exactly the same way as the men scientists and engineers may not be effective because of surrounding environmental and social situations. And so you can see what happened with physicist Susan Emerson. She had been very successful, had had only male mentors because she was in physics as in high school, as an undergraduate, and as a graduate student. But when she was in her faculty position, again, she had a good male mentor, and he thought he was doing right by her. He recommended for her something he typically would recommend for one of his male student or male young colleagues, which he did at the same time. But the other faculty resented it for her and had expected more for her. And so they were angry at the chair, and the faculty voted against her while unanimously supporting a male who came up simultaneously. And she talks about the importance of institutions paying more attention to mentoring women and providing money for networking groups and access. This is something that comes out in the mentoring literature, as you know, is that although it's good to have a mentor, it's really better to have a network of mentors, because not one individual is usually that great in all aspects. Maybe there's somebody who's really good in the research aspect, someone else the teaching aspect, the service, but also it helps to guard against this situation in which she found herself. Here's a contrast, another physicist, Mary Vassar, who talks about the fact that the senior faculty there really did know how to mentor her. It was a situation where the physics department had 36 people, four of whom were women, not great, but not bad as physics departments go nationally. And the senior faculty gave her opportunities, but they didn't overload her with committees, and this allowed her to establish a very solid research career. Lola Barnes talks about what happened with her situation. She did go to a small liberal arts college. Two of the five faculty in the geology department were women. And one of the things she really liked was the supportive environment and the fact that the women would meet together. She found it to be a family-friendly situation. But she also had a Claire Booth Luce professorship. And one thing that she liked about that, and this came across in the Claire Booth Luce professors compared to the National Science Foundation awards, that they, in the Claire Booth Luce situation, are able to use the money for anything they want. So if what they need is childcare, they can use the money to buy that. If they need a technician, they can use it to buy that. If they need a postdoc, they can use it to buy that. Of course, there is not such freedom with the NSF money, you know, government money you can, by and large, not use for childcare. And they found that very useful for getting what they individually needed. So this one-size-fits-all prescription is sometimes not the best way to go in these kinds of things. And the Claire Booth Luce situation there is better. I would say, and it doesn't come across in this particular interview, but some of the others, the Claire Booth Luce folks particularly liked the fact, too, that they had a named professorship. And at some institutions, that allowed them to mix with other named professors who tend to be eminent, more senior folks. And this gave them a certain cachet, which they felt was very useful in setting up collaborations and also for how the institution viewed them. And this is very different from the NSF Power Awards. Some people felt that the Power Awards, and I was a senior program officer at NSF when the Power Awards came in and then when we decided to go to ADVANCE. And people felt that the Power Awards, because they were designated for women, some people mistakenly thought those were not as competitive. Now, in fact, they were more competitive. About 20% of women got power awards, whereas the average percentage of awards of NSF at that time was 30%. It's lower now. So it was actually more difficult to get a power award, but a lot of department chairs said, oh, that's an award for women. That's easier to get. So a lot of it has to do with how it's packaged. And then this is a pretty savvy person, physicist Betsy Forrest, who really tried to apply some of the research. One reason I keep pointing out not just the anecdotes of what the individual women say, but how it connects back to the research, is if you're aware of the research, you can sometimes use that to strategize for yourself and what would work well. So after she completed her undergraduate major in physics, she entered graduate school at a prestigious public university on the West Coast. To try to figure out which lab she should go with, she used what she called the office test. If she saw a student sleeping in the lab or the office, she figured it wasn't a great environment. It must require 24/7 presence. And that was not something she wanted to sign up for. And so she thought that was a bad omen, and she did not go with that. Similarly, when she was looking for a postdoc, she was clearly pregnant with her second child, and she looked at people's reaction to that. She didn't try to hide it because she felt this was going to be the situation she was in. Eventually, she would have this child. And so if people weren't going to be supportive, why go into that environment? And so, you know, that's, I think, one of the questions that we need to learn from this. You know, what does the research show and how that can be applied to our actual lives? The final thing I would like to say in terms of what the research shows is that it's extremely important, of course, to establish your own research independence. And there was a point at which I had to make that decision myself, and a lot of women do too. Often, again, because of the dual career situation, women can get in these postdoctoral situations, research science positions where they're pretty comfortable, but they're running someone else's research agenda. And this ultimately is not going to lead to their being successful in their own career. They need to establish their independence. So here's computer scientist Mary Frail, who talks about how receiving her NSF grant allowed her to build her own career while she was still in the Persons Lab with whom she was postdocing. But instead of working solely on his research, she could begin to publish her own research based on her own work. And then eventually, this allowed her to go for her own tenure track position, where she could build her own reputation. As you can see, over the years, there really has been quite an increase in women in the different disciplines at the different levels in science and engineering. It varies quite a bit. When I started back in the 1960s, it was about 7% women in many of the fields, including in biology, it was only about 10%. As you can see now, in biology, undergraduate degrees are running almost 60% women, master's degrees very high, even over 50% PhDs. Psychology is way up there in the high 70%, even 72% for PhDs. However, there's quite a lot of variation among the fields. At the other end, you have computer science down there, which actually reached its peak in production of women in 1984, when 37% of the undergraduate degrees went to women in computer science. You can see now we're down below 20%. So there's been an actual pretty precipitous drop, and we can talk about that in the discussion period of why that might be the case. Actually, women are doing a little better at the master's and PhD level in computer science. Engineering, although it was only about 3% back in the 60s, as you can see, it's still less than 20% at the undergraduate level. When it comes to faculty positions, there is the usual pyramid situation, in that you have more women at the lower levels, and the higher you go, fewer women. These data are women in the different broadly grouped areas at four-year institutions. If you look at Research One institutions, the percentage of women who are full professors is about 10%. So, and you know, in some fields, of course, it's much less than that. But you can see that there is still quite the glass ceiling, or some people don't like the term glass ceiling. I don't know, they want concrete ceilings, or sometimes they want more mushy ceilings, or something like that. They want spirals, various other things. Anyway, there's still an issue. This is another way of showing the data, again, from NSF. So these are the high participation fields for women, psychology, and medical sciences. Medium participation fields are biosciences and social sciences. Medium low participation fields, physical sciences and mathematics. And then, as I mentioned previously, the really low participation fields, computer sciences and engineering. But overall, there has been tremendous progress. Now, this looks pretty flat, as you can see, since 89, except computer science has actually dropped. If you extend it back to the 60s, there's quite an increase even in these fields. So these are the pluses. And I don't want to say that over time there hasn't been change. There has been change. On the other hand, as somebody who studies this kind of research, I would say I do see a few negative or danger signals. And one of these has to do with the area of women and patenting. As you know, right now, in most countries, including the United States, technology transfer, translational medicine, however you want to frame it, the more applied is the direction that things are going. That is where the money is. That is where the new fields are. Whether it's biotechnology, information technology, nanotechnology, all of these very much involve patenting. Now, patent data, we can get into a whole discussion. They are not great data. They're very difficult to collect. There are problems about the names. Oftentimes, there are people's names on there that have nothing to do with the science or engineering. You know, like lawyers are on there for a variety of reasons. In some fields, like computer science, they actually put thicket patents around for the software and that kind of thing. But the data are overwhelming in the huge gap with regard to gender. So that you can see that in all countries, in all disciplines, and in all sectors, by which I mean government, academia, and industry, there is a huge gender gap in patenting. To give you a couple of examples, a study was done at Big School, which was MIT, and in the biology department, approximately 74% of the men had patented, about 30% of the women had patented. At younger, the more junior people, the disparity was not as great, but it still existed. And so it's a huge issue. So here you can see some of the international data. This is Rainer Fritsch's data from Fraunhofer. And you can see the US, although it's increasing over time, still very low level of patenting, 11%. Germany, Austria, basically the countries that have slightly higher levels of women patenting are not some of the countries we associate with world-class science. Here just shows you, again, the different fields. Even a field such as pharmaceuticals, which has about 50% women, you see women are getting 20, 25% of the patents. Something like energy machinery, which has very few women in it, women get a very, very low percentage of the patents. Now, why aren't women obtaining patents at the same rate as men? And there have been some pretty interesting studies done on these, and actually I have a couple of whole lectures on this, so I won't go into great detail here. But I would say just a few of the things, and these are, I emphasize them because these are general trends that we know from research on women in science and engineering that you see over time when there are gender issues. So one is that there are fewer opportunities or differential opportunities. What do I mean here? It's reported that at conferences, you know, when there's a display or something, that venture capitalists will approach a man and a woman, and they'll start talking to the man, and he will even say, this is about her research, and direct the venture capitalist or the person who's interested to the woman, and they'll still talk more to him, so that there's a fewer opportunities that way. There were studies done showing that at institutions where there are pretty high levels of patenting and where students are led into patenting and technology transfer, that even students who had the same advisor, there was a gender discrepancy, that somehow the men students were learning more about technology transfer and patenting more while in graduate school or a postdoc than were the women students who had the same advisor. And so this suggests that something was going on. Sort of like when I was in graduate school, it was not uncommon that somehow the guys learned how to write grants, but we didn't really get that kind of mentoring. And I don't exactly know why. It wasn't that we were covering, we just did not, we're not encouraged to do that somehow. Second issue has to do with homophily and mentoring and networks. The research shows, again, that women have more women in their networks. And since women tend not to be patenting and doing these things, there is this kind of major effect with that. Men have, of course, more men in their networks, and they have some women. But women have, the men that women have in their networks tend to be their students, fewer of the senior men who often can open those doors. Work-family issues are often very big here. You know, I live in San Francisco, not far from Silicon Valley. So there are a lot of startups all the time, and everybody talks about the 24/7 nature of those, you know, people living in the office, eating pizza under the desk, you know, all this kind of stuff. Not very conducive, not very family friendly. I mean, you have to ask why the guys want to do this, but anyway, it's not a really good work-family situation. Gender stereotypes seem to be extremely prevalent in this field. I had a good friend when I was at Georgia Tech who was a big tissue engineer, and she had quite a few patents. When she moved from Texas to Georgia, she was coming out to Silicon Valley to try to get funding, and she could not get funding from the venture capitalists. And she asked somebody, and they said, well, you know, you have three problems. You're the wrong gender, you're too short, and you don't play golf. And so she hired a partner who was a tall guy who played golf, and she did get funding quite immediately for that patent. It's very much a bottom line decision. I did some interviews in Silicon Valley and talked to the venture capitalists and talked to some of the people about, you know, how they make the decisions of what they're going to fund and what they'll go for. For them, it is a business decision. And so they said often, you know, they don't actually always like to see married couples come in with a product or something they want to have. And they're thinking, if the marriage breaks up, you know, we're going to lose our company or we're going to lose our product. Or, you know, or they will overtly say these things that we don't anymore. Like, oh, is she going to get pregnant, you know, or something like that. They see that this will affect the bottom line. So this is much more a kind of cowboy mentality, if you will, in the whole venture capital world. There is some evidence that women select this for themselves or select against this for themselves, too. Women tend to be more risk averse. A lot of the women will express, I didn't want to get an MBA. If I had wanted to, I would have gone to business school or I would have gone into banking. I wanted to do the science. I didn't want to run a business, so I don't want to go into technology transfer or translational medicine, that kind of thing. And then the other issue that's very big is geography. People know the hot spots for this, right? It's the Silicon Valley, it's San Diego, if it's biology, it's Boston, and maybe it's the research triangle. That's kind of it. So again, all those dual career geographically proximity issues come into play here. So I raise this because this is the direction that things are going worldwide, including the United States, in science and engineering. And so if women aren't there, I think this is a serious issue right now. I also wanted to talk about why it makes a difference when you have women in an area and the importance of senior women, because I've done some research. You know, as I get old and gray, I of course get very interested in what is going on with the senior women. And if since you had Nancy Hopkins here, you know that in her original study, they really talked about issues for senior women in science and engineering. The problems with inadequate space, access to graduate students not being nominated for awards, not getting the perks of the profession. The way we address that nationally, and I had a role in that from National Science Foundation in putting together the ADVANCE project, we originally were looking at what to do to get women at senior level positions. But if you look at mostly what we've done in ADVANCE, it has been more helpful for junior level. You know, because there have been all these emphasis on getting tenure and promotion, on family-friendly policies, practices. In some ways, that makes sense, because if you don't have junior women and don't get the junior women through, you're not going to have any senior women. However, it really has left the issues of senior women pretty unaddressed. And I've done some research on that, which I won't spend a lot of time on here. But I would say that nationally, we're kind of coming to a consensus about what might be helpful for junior women. But to be truthful, we do not have much of a clue for what to do for senior women. And in fact, on the airplane here, I was working on a paper I'm doing right now where I've gone back and resurveyed the power awardees and to ask them 10 to 15 years later, you know, what do you think the issues are and do you think they're different for senior and junior women? And people think they're different, but they don't know what they are for senior women. So it's a real issue. But why is it important to have senior women? Well, first of all, senior women, I think particularly senior women scientists in the public realm, are very much more able to become presidents, and I would like to show you that. And then also the impact that they can have on the scientific research in terms of what kinds of questions are asked and how fields can really be changed. So if you look at senior leadership, right now about 26% of college presidents are women. This is a large change. Even in the last decade, it was down around 17%. About half of the Ivy League presidents are women, exactly half are women. Brown University, it was Ruth Simmons when I wrote the book, and it's now Christina Paxton. Harvard, of course, has Drew Gilpin Faust. Penn has Amy Gutman. And Princeton, until later this academic year, has Shirley Tilghman. As you can see, only one of these, Shirley Tilghman, is a scientist or engineer. However, this is typical of private institutions. They do not necessarily have scientists or engineers. The men also fit this profile. And I think because some of the fundraising has more to do with donors and that kind of relationship, so it's a different community. MIT, the president now is Raphael Reif, was Susan Hockfield till 2012. At RPI, it's still Shirley Jackson. Of course, both Susan Hockfield and Shirley Jackson, scientists or engineers. Shirley Jackson, as you know, is African-American scientist. And this is typical, of course, of technological institutions. You would expect them to have a scientist or engineer as president. Public institutions, four of the big 10 institutions are headed by women. Sally Ann Mason, Mary Sue Coleman, Luana Simon, and until, is it January, when the governor of Indiana comes in to head up Purdue, France Cordova. As you can see, three of them are scientists or engineers, and this is quite typical of the male Big Ten presidents. Then you look at the University of California system. Three out of the 10 UC chancellors are women. UC Davis is Linda Katehi, who's an engineer, who used to be here in Illinois, of course, as provost. And then UC San Diego, Marianne Fox, a chemist, and then UCSF, Sue Desmond-Hellman, who's a physician. They are all scientists, engineers, or physicians, and this is true that 10 out of the 10 UC chancellors are scientists, engineers, or physicians. They are all. Now, why is this? In my opinion, it's because a lot of the skills that scientists and engineers have to have translate pretty well into institutional leadership skills, particularly for public institutions, where you have to do a lot of work in government with the legislature, follow the federal trends, follow the state trends, keep up with what's going on. So what do you do in science and engineering? You manage budgets, you manage people, you manage projects, you manage facilities and equipment, you try to obtain funding, you follow national and state trends in government and industry to obtain that funding. You have to collaborate with others inside and outside the university. You have to complete projects on time. And there's a lot of moving back and forth between sectors. I mean, look at the Obama administration. He's got quite a few people from academic science in his administration, not just in the scientific portions, but in other areas. And so I think these translate well into leadership skills. Why is it important to have successful senior women scientists? Well, I think it's particularly important because it's not until we had large numbers of women in certain fields that we began to have different questions asked and the field influence. The primary example of this, of course, is cardiovascular disease. I'm old enough that I remember in the 60s when all the cardiovascular research was done on men. Heart disease was defined using the male model, and it was not at all uncommon for women to show up at emergency rooms exhibiting signs of cardiovascular disease, but it would not be recognized because it had not been studied yet in women. And although there was some recognition that women were dying at the same frequency with heart disease, since it was 10 years later and, you know, it exhibited differently, they really didn't know that. And then what happened about the treatments? As you may know, when angioplasty and cardiac bypass were first pioneered and tested, they were less successful in women than in men. More women died from angioplasty and cardiac bypass than men. Why? Not a surprise. The tests were normed in white men, and their vessels overall were slightly larger. So when you run that Roto-Rooter thing through for the angioplasty, it tended to burst more of the women's vessels than it did men. It was also not very effective in Asian men, who tended to have smaller vessels than the male population on whom it had been normed. So it wasn't until we began to have women in leadership positions, such as Bernadine Healy as head of the NIH, who actually made the comment that it was like Yentl syndrome, you know, that when a woman could show that she had the same kind of cardiovascular disease as a man, then she would be treated appropriately. But if she showed up exhibiting the other types that sometimes occur in women, it would not be recognized. And so this was very important. And people used to say to me, why do you care about gender issues in women's studies? I would say, it's a matter of life and death. People are actually dying because you do not recognize that. So I would say having women in key decision-making positions in the scientific and technological workforce is critical for the future of society. The importance of leadership in science has been illustrated in other areas too, besides healthcare. For example, Shirley Malcolm has said, would we have had the fiasco in the airbag design that we had in the auto industry if there had been a woman on the airbag design team? I'm not saying that a man couldn't have thought of, how's this gonna work in a really short woman or a child? But perhaps if you're the person who's always having to reach up and everything, that might come to your attention more easily than having, you know, a tall man think of this kind of thing. I'm not saying it's an essentialist thing that other people can't think of that, but you're more likely to if you experience this frustration on a daily basis. And so I would like to close that by saying that I think having more women as well as more diversity in general in the composition of the STEM pool is extremely important because I think it leads to more ideas and more creative science. In January of 2010, there was a play called Truth Values, One Girl's Romp Through MIT's Male Math Maze. And that played in San Francisco, sponsored by the Mathematical Science Research Institute of Berkeley. And it was concurrent with the American Mathematical Association meetings, which were being held there that year. The play also had a pretty extended run at the Central Square Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a performance at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Lawrence H. Summers is credited with helping to inspire the play, according to Gioia Dicari, the author of the autobiographical one-woman drama and its sole actress. And she said, I quote, "The play's prologue discusses Summers, whose controversial 2005 remarks questioning the aptitude of women to study math and science contributed to his ouster from Harvard." Dicari then tells the story of her math journey through a parade of real-life characters, including math nerds who wanted to paw her, and professors who asked her to bring cookies to a meeting or wondered why she wasn't at home raising children. And I quote again, "The question is why a woman who graduates with top honors from Berkeley in math and gets accepted into an MIT doctoral program ends up leaving," she says in an interview. That's the play. And so I offer this talk partially as an answer to that question, so that you can see some of the experiences that women had, that I had, but also, I think, so that we can learn from them and so that we can strategize about some ways to make things different, both as mentors and for those of us who are women in science and engineering, because I think it's very important that we have productive careers and make these changes that will make a difference for daily lives and society. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.